From 12 News, this is Newsmakers.
Welcome to Newsmakers. I'm Tim White. 1 year ago Monday, Rhode Island announced its first case of COVID-19. And all this week, 12 News has been looking back at a turbulent year and the region's response to the coronavirus. Other than Governor Gina Raimondo herself, Rhode Island Department of Health Director Dr. Nicole Alexander Scott has been a central figure in the state's response to the pandemic. As part of our coverage, 12 News anchor Kim Kaloonian sat down with Dr. Alexander Scott to reflect on the past year, what she learned, and what brought her to this moment.
What got you interested in medicine all those years ago? What made you want to become a doctor?
Well, I like attributing it back to my parents, really. My mother was a director of nursing when she retired from medicine, so I grew up in a hospital setting. And I'm extra proud of that because growing up in Virginia and moving to New York City, because of the color of her skin, she had been told she'd never be able to be a nurse or a teacher or any professional that she wanted to, and was sent to a school that wouldn't allow her to have that happen. And she went to her own night school instead and persevered on her own, getting her own college credits, getting her own registered nurse degree, master's of public administration, and retired as director of nursing. So that was one. And then my father, who passed away, unfortunately, when I was 11, used to say when I was a little girl, she's going to be a doctor someday. And I actually didn't know that until I was in medical school.
Wow.
So I'd say those, and certainly God, are huge influences into why I ultimately went on to become a doctor. And then it's just a fun story beyond that on why I chose infectious diseases and internal medicine and pediatrics and ultimately public health, which all ties in so perfectly. And I wouldn't change it for the world.
When you made the decision to pursue infectious disease, public health, did you ever think you would find yourself in the middle of a global pandemic running a state health department?
Well, interestingly enough, I was drawn to public health when the last pandemic was here, H1N1, really was introduced to just so many of my heroes in public health when I walked into our emergency operations center downstairs at the department. And Dr. David Gifford, as the director, took me under his wings, and all of the team here embraced me. And I never looked back from knowing the impact that you can have at a population level within public health. So you certainly hope that you don't have too many pandemics in your career, and you can never imagine what each additional pandemic is going to be like. I wouldn't say it was a total surprise, but it was also something that no one could have imagined.
Yeah, take me back to February, maybe even January of last year. When did you start to get a sense this thing is coming and it's probably going to end up here before we know it?
Likely around that February time, prior to us having our own case, many of us within the public health world began to have memories of our H1N1 days and the 23-hour days that were spent, and a tremendous amount of work and energy. We activated our COVID-19 task force prior to our first case. We activated our incident command system prior to our first case. So in that mid-February timeframe was when we began gearing up for thinking that it was going to likely be similar to what we experienced before. This certainly has ended up being 100-fold more significant or, you know, extensive than what we dealt with in 2009. But that was when we began to have the hints that this was coming.
And when you got the news that the first case had been identified, what went through your mind?
It's here. You know, we spoke for a while prior to that happening that, you know, it was going to happen, not an if, but a when. Mm-hmm. And so when it did happen, it was that confirmation, and we were ready at that point, you know, for what we understood be coming. We had prepared for weeks and weeks. Our state health laboratory had done a phenomenal job accelerating their work to be able to identify it earlier than before, and we knew how to engage with our partners. So it was, you know, time when our first case arrived.
I wanted to ask you about all of the media attention that you've received. Mm-hmm. I mean, you've been out in the forefront of these press briefings now the entire time. Mm-hmm. Sometimes the press has a certain way of asking the questions. What has all of that been like for you to navigate, and has it been frustrating at times to hear that pushback?
It certainly can be, but you also understand, you know, where it's coming from. I think some of the frustration is just not being able to fully explain, you know, all of the background, because then people would understand a little bit better. But sometimes that's not even important. It's really about just making sure that we are responding. And, you know, a part of public health, and particularly this role, is being able to communicate effectively and do that in the midst of a crisis. As part of the Association for State and Territorial Health Officials, ASTO, a national organization that I was a past president of, some of the initial introduction to stepping into this role included, you know, how will you engage with the media, and what does, you know, the crisis, media crisis response look like, mm-hmm. and how can you communicate accurately and be transparent and also quick in being able to share what's going on. So it's funny, some of the role-playing sessions to teach were like, this may never happen, but what if you're da-da-da, and so often it just happened during this response. So you think back on some of those, and, you know, even more times when you're preparing. Mm-hmm. And you have to go with it. I mean, it's part of the journey. You see, Governor Raimondo is amazing at being able to do it, and we look forward to working with the incoming Governor McKee, and we'll just keep going, because it's really about doing what's needed for Rhode Islanders and for the people.
Looking back on the past year, I know you had to make some hard decisions. Hindsight is 2020, so knowing what you know now, if you could go back in time and change something, what would that be? Do you have any regrets?
I wouldn't say regrets. They are definitely lessons learned, which are important. It would be a problem if I said, no, you know, everything was fine, or we didn't learn anything. We've absolutely learned, and I've expressed it to our team that our goal is to come out stronger on the other side of this. And for myself, I've wanted to make sure that I shift my own DNA so that these are lessons learned that I carry with me going forward, and I don't have to learn them again in the future. But there are always questions of how can I be more assertive in making, you know, the case for what's needed from a public health standpoint, or in advocating for the team, or in helping the team understand that, you know, there's another approach to how we can do this, or setting myself up for success and being able to balance everything. So these are lessons that I definitely intend to bring with me over the course of my career.
Yeah, how has this experience changed you personally and professionally?
In many ways, definitely in many ways. I'd say the most prominent, I think having lost my father at a young age, it already taught me to have a sense of appreciation just for what you have and for life, and not taking things for granted. So I already had an element of that, and certainly the pandemic really strengthened that understanding. Even on the toughest days, I still am blessed and thankful, you know, to have a family, to have loved ones, to have a job, you know, to be able to fulfill a purpose that I'm able to respond to. So looking at those blessings are just so critical during times like this, and having some foundation and, you know, family and faith and loved ones and coworkers to rely on and encourage each other is always key. So that's something that I am strengthened now and going forward in making sure that I continue to stay grounded in and always keep things in perspective, even when, you know, days may get unique or interesting. And then always being able to maintain understanding of who I am in decision making, and knowing that there are going to be different inputs, and those need to be taken into account, but also being able to stay steady in what I feel is important and be able to speak to that. So that's something that I am thankful to have grown in and look forward to taking with me in the future as well.
Speaking of the future, if you and I are sitting here 1 year from today, what do you hope life looks like?
Well, I definitely hope that vaccinations for COVID is a normal part of everyone's everyday routine, that the majority of our population has been vaccinated and we're able to go forward interacting and engaging with each other, but taking with us some of the advances that we've gained. There are some conferences that can just be by Zoom now instead of having to travel or go in person. But also looking post-COVID at what we can do to make sure we bounce forward after this. And so when I really think about our communities of color and our communities that have been on the front lines and disproportionately hit hardest by COVID, that is not a surprise. It was what we have talked about prior to COVID in addressing determinants of health and making sure that there are investments at the community level to help ensure, regardless of the zip code that you're from, that you have access to quality education and schools, to good job opportunities, to good housing. I am hopeful that both from a race equity as well as from a health equity standpoint, a year from now, we're able to take not only the lessons learned, but the investments to really build into our communities an ability to ensure that with the next adversity or the everyday adversities, that every community equitably has the resources they need to respond appropriately, that their education and their schools have what's needed and are, you know, in quality buildings and have the supplies and equipment that they need to make sure that their children are most equipped, and across the board, housing, nutrition, transportation, access, employment opportunities, all of those are what I'm hopeful going forward we can use to uplift both community health and our economy's health to be strengthened in the future.
When we come back, Ted Nisi joins me in studio. We break down major news in the hospital merger talks. Plus, Rhode Islanders are just days away, we're pretty sure, from having a new governor. Stay with us. You're watching Newsmakers. Welcome back to Newsmakers. I'm Tim White. I'm joined by my colleague, 12 News politics editor Ted Nisi. Ted, the pandemic aside, the biggest story this past week, it was a major development in the soap opera between Lifespan and Care New England. I mean, honestly, it's like when Ross and Rachel from
you
Friends.
You stole that from me.
Oh, did I?
You did.
Yeah. All right. Well, it's a fantastic joke, and I delivered it better. But the leaders of the hospitals and Brown University released a video statement to coincide with the announcement. So let's take a quick listen to some of that.
This is a moment in time that we cannot let slip through our grasp. Rhode Island is one of the only states in the country that does not have a single integrated academic healthcare system. Massachusetts has four or five. Rhode Island has none. If you think about if we don't do it now, if it doesn't happen this time, the alternatives, I think, will not be in the best interest of the community or the patients we serve.
We want to be a leader in cancer care in Rhode Island. We don't want people to have to go to Boston or New York for, if God forbid, they get cancer. And so we can develop a world-class cancer center that conducts research, that lets us treat patients better, and that provides Rhode Islanders with an option, an alternative to going elsewhere. So it's this integration of research, discovery, patient care, clinical care that is going to be spurred by this integration. I find that very, very exciting.
So, Ted, as you know, my excellent and original Ross and Rachel joke from Friends, that show goes back to the 90s. So does this saga with Care New England and Lifespan. And this time it feels different. We've heard about talks of them before. They've fallen apart. Obviously, it's different because they make this announcement. What has changed?
Well, it's
this
funny,
time
and
around?
It's funny, Tim. You know, I usually date it back to the 90s. Myself and my stories, but I was thinking the other day, you could even argue it dates to at least the 80s, because is Women and Infants built on land owned by Lifespan-owned care? Women and Infants is Care New England, Lifespan's Rhode Island Hospital, leased the land for Women and Infants in 1983 because they always thought they would come together, and I don't think they thought it would take, you know, my entire lifetime for this to get there. But I think what's happening now, I think there's a couple factors. The pandemic really did change a lot. It has created major financial strains, particularly on Care New England, which was already strained beforehand. It led to collaboration. You know, there's in a foxhole, you don't check the corporate papers, right? And they were, I think, exchanging PPE at the height of the crisis and stuff that they'd never done before. Made the CEOs work together in a different way. And then you have the business aspect of it, which is, you know, hospitals are being merged. They are consolidating all across the country. And on their own, I think it's hard to imagine Lifespan and Care New England being able to stay independent. So that means you'd probably see one or both gobbled up by either Yale New Haven coming up from the south out of Connecticut, or partners coming down from the north in Boston, which already wanted to take over Care New England, or a for-profit company from outside. And I think a lot of state leaders, the governor, Sheldon Whitehouse, Neil Steinberg at the Rhode Island Foundation, really are concerned that if the hospitals aren't under local control, not only would it affect care, but it would affect economic development in the state's reach. And of course, Brown has a big incentive on that too.
Sure. You know, and your reference to the pandemic to me is not lost, because right when the pandemic started, that the relationship between the two hospital groups was about as caustic as it ever has been. But it wasn't lost on us when Dr. James Finale of Care New England and Dr. Tim Babineau of Lifespan appeared on this program via Zoom together to say, let's put all that aside. We have a central and focused mission that we have to work on together. So I think that is true. So why might this work this time?
Well, I think, you know, the reasons I said before that, you know, instead of the status quo no longer looks like an option, you know, something is going to happen, particularly to Care New England. And so I think nobody involved in the discussions believes that it's going to go on like it is now. So it's, do you want this option or a different option? But you can't keep just these independent hospital groups, it looks like, the way the industry is going. And then Brown. I mean, Brown is, you know, Brown has deep relations with both these groups. Obviously, they have the only medical school in the state. But historically, Brown has kind of been on the side of this, kind of, we want a good health system. Chris Paxson and the dean of the medical school, Jack Lyce, they are all in on this. They're putting $125 million into it. Mm-hmm. They've already rationalized on the doctor's practices with the creation of Brown Physicians a few years ago, which had been a pain point in the past. So I think in some ways, each of the failed merger attempts, particularly the more recent ones, I think brought some stuff into focus that helped these leaders, who've all been in place for years now, see the game. And then, of course, the governor, even in recent weeks, my understanding is, has made this one of her last pushes to try to get this over the finish line.
Before we get to, I want to play a little sound with the Attorney General, Peter Noronha, because he plays a huge role in this. What are you going to be looking for as a reporter who's been covering this thing for years? What are you going to be looking for besides the regulatory approvals that have to happen to make this go forward? You know, I know I'm interested in what is the structure of mm-hmm. this. Who's going to run the mm-hmm. new healthcare system? What are you looking for?
What's it called? You know, I wonder. My guess is they're going to put Brown's name on it. Will we have Brown University Health System or Brown Rhode Island Healthcare or something like Yale New Haven?
They have a good brand,
exactly.
Right?
So that's a small thing, but it's interesting. And then I think I want to see, you know, frankly, it does all play in with it. What do they have to do to get the regulators comfortable? So, for example, could they have to spin off Kent Hospital or a different facility. I don't want to scare anybody. That might not be, but that is the kind
of thing. That wouldn't be popular with, say, Senator Michael McCaffrey, of course,
potentially,
right?
Although it also depends where it goes. You know, if Kent goes to another good option, you know, it's just they are going to be so dominant if they are brought together. I don't want to, you know, it's also important to look at the downsides, or at least the concerns here, which is that 77% of the patients who went to a hospital around went to Lifespan or Care New England in 2020. This is, you know, there's a reason regulators are going to say, all right, we have to really look at this one.
All right, so Ted is using regulators, plural. There are three: the Federal Trade Commission, the Rhode Island Department of Health, and the Rhode Island Attorney General's Office. And we heard from Peter Noronha this week when we sat down with him about his reaction to this announcement. Take a listen.
Yeah, look, you know, I'm one of the regulators who will be evaluating that transaction. So, you know, in that role, you know, I'm not here to be a cheerleader for it. You know, my job is to analyze it and to make sure that it meets the criteria that it needs to meet for us to approve it, or approve it with conditions, or ultimately not approve it if that's what is best for Rhode Islanders. But I'll say this: what's critically important, you know, they're simple principles, but they're critically important. Quality, accessible, affordable health care. The question for me will be, using those broad principles, will this transaction achieve it or won't it? And exactly what is it about this transaction that we need to take? What steps do we need to take to ensure that if it is approved, that the conditions around that transaction are such that we can achieve those three broad purposes?
Rhode Island Attorney General Peter Noronha. And Ted, you know, we should point out the Attorney General's office isn't just a rubber stamp to this process. That it's been a pinch point for this.
Yeah, I mean, if I'm remembering my history right, I think the first merger after it in the 1990s, Sheldon Whitehouse was AG. The second, I think Patrick Lynch was Attorney General. And in both cases, I think those were attorneys general who had some concerns and, you know, didn't make it easy for the hospital groups. I'm not saying they were right or wrong, but just it wasn't a rubber stamp, as you say, Tim. And so they told me, I was on the phone with Dr. Babineau, Dr. Finale, Chris Paxton on Tuesday, I think. Thank you. And they said they want this done by the end of the year. Well, the regulators have a big say in whether that timeline is possible. So that's something else I'll be watching. Are the regulators kind of, you know, is there a sort of a cooperative process to get through the review, or is it very adversarial?
Yeah, and look, the Attorney General's office told me on Thursday they haven't even received the application yet, and that's when the
And those applications,
they're massive.
They're massive. The amount of documents.
Like 10 mortgage documents in one.
It's like that story you did years ago in the 38 Studios documents in Max Wistow's office. I remember, and you were just walking with him through boxes and boxes. It's going to be like that.
All right, so I want to pivot to the governor, but it's actually a decent transition because, you know, this might be lost as part of the governor's legacy. But if she hadn't stepped in, you have said to me, if there were a more passive governor with this, partners might be, you know, owning what is Lifespan right now.
Yeah, I tend to think so. The partners deal was on track, and Care New England had no interest, it appeared, in moving away from that just a couple of years ago. And then Governor Mundo stepped in and said, you know, under pressure, she wasn't the only one, but she was hearing it from Sheldon Whitehouse, Neil Steinberg, folks like that, that they said, you know, we really need to try once more to see if there could be a locally controlled hospital system. And when she stepped in, partners was, you know, took their ball and went home. And that left Care New England, you know, there was bad blood for a while there, but, you know, it led to the current situation that has now led to, you know, them coming together, discussing it again. And then also the potential, there's still talk that someday down the road, maybe the Brown Health System, if that's what's created, becomes part of partners down here. You know, that's the way the world is going. But yes, Tim, the governor is well aware, as is Chris Paxton, as the two hospital CEOs, that this is a huge legacy thing, and also something they all, based on everything they tell me, they all actually believe is important and could help Rhode Island long term. We'll see.
2 minutes left. We have to get to this. And I feel like we talk about it just about every week. But there is actually a vote scheduled, so we might have a new governor next week.
Yeah. So, I know I feel like I've come on here and misled people because they keep slipping. I've done my best.
But you've always said the timelines are in question.
Exactly. So the U.S. Senate's voting Monday night, a preliminary vote on Governor Raimondo, which should set up a final vote Tuesday. That's the general expectation I'm hearing this morning. And, you know, the Democrats control the Senate. I'd expect quite a few Republicans to vote for as well. It was just a matter of scheduling the vote, not would she have the vote. So that means, you know, once she's sworn in, she won't be the governor anymore. And so I would expect at this rate, you'd probably have a new governor, Dan McKee, you see him there, by Tuesday evening.
And as soon as she's sworn in, she won't be governor anymore because there's actually language in the state constitution, right?
Yeah, we've been getting this question a lot. So I asked some smart lawyers, people who know this. The constitution, renowned constitution, says once a general officer has accepts a other post for another government,
federal appointment,
yeah. They are no longer the governor. So if so, that would mean the second, you know, she puts her hand on the oath, I presume Vice President Harris will give her the oath. As soon as she says it, she's not the governor. But my sense is they're thinking more, she will, once it's clear what the timing is, send a letter, I believe, to Secretary Gorbea saying, I hereby resign as of 2 o'clock on Tuesday, so that it's kind of cleaner, and then boom, McKee can be sworn in and he's the governor.
All right, so one other thing that got lost this week is Ted wrote an important story on the state of the Rhode Island budget right now. Quick headline, what's the deficit?
It's falling, it's $300-something million, and if the Biden bill passes, it probably switches to a surplus. It's
but
that big.
It must be so hard to figure out what the structural deficit is with all this federal money
sloshing
around.
Eyes, I love budgets, and I was glazing over last night trying to keep track of the moving
wow.
money.
If Ted is glazing over in the but it is an important story, and it really kind of gets you up to speed on what the state budget is. So make sure you go to WPRI.com. For Ted Nacy, I'm Tim White. We'll see you next week on Newsmakers.